Good evening. This is Orson Welles, your producer of a special series of broadcasts presented by the makers of Pabst Blue Ribbon, the Mercury Summer Theater of the Air.
Tonight and every Friday night, Pabst Blue Ribbon presents you with a front row seat in America's favorite summer theater. So, while America's famous producer, writer, director, Orson Welles, entertains you, pour yourself a tall, frosted glass of Pabst Blue Ribbon and enjoy at the same time great entertainment and this truly great beer. And now, Mr. Welles.
Tonight, the Mercury brings you two great American short stories. The first, as per last week's promise, is by Sherwood Anderson. His loving study of puppy love at the turn of the century is called I'm a Fool.
It began at 3 o'clock one October afternoon in 1912 as I sat in the grandstand at the fall trotting and pacing meet at Sandusky, Ohio. It was a good hard jolt for me, and it all came about through my own foolishness, too. The summer before, I'd left my hometown with a fellow called Bert French with two horses as campaigners through the race meets that year. Gee, it was fun. We got to county seat town maybe on a Saturday or Sunday, and the fair began next Tuesday, and you took your horses to the track and fed them. You got your good clothes out of a box and put them on. The town is full of farmers gaping because they see you as horse race people, and all the dudes come around asking questions, and all you did was to lie and lie and all you could, you know, about horses you had and lie and say you owned one. Gee, it's... Oh, this is what I want to tell my story about. We got home late November, and I promised Mother I'd quit the races for good. There's a lot of things you gotta promise a mother because she don't know no better. And then as I started to tell you, the fall races came to Sandusky, and I got the day off and went. And I had on my good clothes and my new brown derby hat and a stand-up collar. I had $40 in my pocket and three 25-cent cigars. That was bought me at the West House by a fellow with a cane and a Windsor tie. Gee, it was fun being on a track again. Gee, it was fun being on a track again. There was my old friend Bert French standing around with his horses. Hello, Bert.
Well, hello, Joe. Hello, stranger.
How you been, Bert?
Oh, never better. Say, you got any money, Joe?
Sure.
I'd like to watch it go.
Like it fine, Bert.
All right, come over here, then. I'll tell you something. Now, listen, Joe. In the second race, the 218 pace, there's a horse I'm handling. Abu Ben Adam. There he is, number seven. That gelding's fast as a streak, Joe. Belongs to a fella called Mathers in Marriott, Ohio. We got him marked at 221, but he can step in 08.
08, gee.
In the first heat, don't you touch him. He'll go around like an ox, hit to a plow. After that, you get a right down and lay on your pile.
Thanks, Bert, a lot. Have a cigar?
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Well, sir, I went and bought myself the best seat I could get.
What about corn, Chris? Strawberry bars?
Right in front of myself, I could see that there was a fellow with a couple of girls, and they was about my age. And the young fellow was a nice guy, all right. He had his sister with him and another girl, and the sister looked around over his shoulder. Accidentally at first, not intending to start anything. She wasn't that kind. And her eyes and mine happened to meet. You know how it is. Gee, she was a peach. She had a soft dress, kind of blue stuff, and she blushed when she looked right at me, and so did I. She was the nicest girl I ever seen in my life. Well, pretty soon the horses came in for the 218 pace, and there was Bert's horse in among the rest.
How we go down this time?
Well, you know as much about it as I do.
What about the brown one there with the long tail? He's kind of cute.
Heck, man, that mare couldn't beat a streetcar. They looked up kind of surprised, but they didn't seem mad. And anyway, I'd done it now. Might as well go on. Maybe I can help you folks. There's a horse in this race, number seven. That horse is as fast as a streak. Abu Ben Adam, his name
is.
Abu Ben Adam. But look, don't go betting on this first heat, because he'll pace it like a lame cow. But when the first heat is over, go right down and lay your pile on Abu Ben Adam. He'll come right out and skin him alive.
That's what I told her. Gee, and... what did that young fellow do but have the nerve to turn and ask the man next to him to get up and change places with me so I could sit with his crowd?
I want you to meet Miss Eleanor Woodbury.
Pleased to meet you.
And this is my sister, Lucy Wesson. Oh, my name's Wilbur. We're from Tiffin, Ohio.
Popcorn,
I suppose it was their having such swell names got me off the trolley. And then that girl, you know, how a fella is. There's something in that
Kind of nice clothes and kind of nice eyes she had, and the way she looked at me while before over her brother's shoulder and me looking back at her and both of us blushing. I couldn't show her up for a boob, could I? I made a fool of myself. That's what I did.
Glad to know you all. My name's Walter Mathis.
How do you do, Mr. Mathis?
I'm from Marietta, Ohio.
And you really think this horse is going to win, Mr. Mathis?
Then I told him all the smashingest lie you ever heard. I said my father owned this horse, you know, a boob and Adam, and it was supposed to be a secret because I told him our family was proud, never had gone in for racing that way.
Here's what I think of that horse. Wilbur, will you do me the favor when you go down to place these 30 bills on a boob and Adam at whatever odds you can get? I'd go myself, but I just soon our trainer and his wife didn't see me. I'm supposed to be here keeping an eye on him, incognito. And sure enough, Abu Ben Adam went off his stride up the backstretch and looked like a wooden horse or a sick one and came in to be last. What'd I tell you? Like a lame cow.
You said you were right, Mr. Mathers.
Then this Wilbur Wesson went down to the betting place out of the grandstand, Miss Woodbury with him, and Lucy Wesson and I was left alone together like on a desert island.
Gee, Miss Lucy, I'd like to show you our place down at Marietta. It's on a hill. A great old red brick house with the stables behind it, way up on a hill, up above the Ohio River.
Oh, I like rivers.
Her eyes were shining. Then she kind of, with her shoulder, you know, kind of touched me. You know how a woman can do. They get close, but not getting gay either. You know what they do. Gee. I began to wish I was on the square with her and to see what a fool I'd been. There wasn't any way of getting myself on the square now. There ain't any Walter Mathers. Like I said to her, there ain't ever been one. But if there was, I bet I'd go to Marietta, Ohio and shoot him tomorrow. And then Wilbur Weston come back with Miss Woodbury and he'd gone and bet $50 on this horse and the girls had gone and put in $10 each of their own money, too. Gee, I was sick then, but came out okay.
There he goes!
Ben Adam stepped the next three heats like a bushel of spoiled eggs going to market before they could be found out.
Yeah.
He's
coming up!
Well, we all got 9-2 for our money after the race. We had a hack downtown. Wilbur stood us a swell supper at the West House and a bottle of champagne besides. And there I was with that girl, big boob that I am. And she wasn't saying much. I wasn't saying much either. One thing I know, she wasn't stuck on me because of that lie about my father being rich and that lie about all that. There's a way you know, you know. Perhaps somebody, there's a kind of girl. You see, just once in your life, you don't get busy and make hay, then you're gone for good and all. You might just well go jump off a bridge because what it means is you want that girl to be your wife and you want nice things around her like nice flowers and swell clothes and you want her to have the kids you're going to have and good music played and, you know, not ragtime, gee. Well, there's a place over near Sandusky across a kind of bay. It's called Cedar Point, and after we had supper, we went over to it in the lodge, just the four of us by ourselves.
What time's that train, Wilbur?
10:40.
And is that the last train?
Yeah, that's the last train.
Oh, Shaw.
Over at Cedar Point, there was a beach. You could walk along, get where it was dark, and we went there. She didn't talk hardly at all. Neither did I. I was thinking how glad I was my mother was all right and always made us kids learn to eat with a fork at the table, you know, and not spill soup and not be noisy and rough like a gang you see around a racetrack that way.
Hey, Lucy! Lucy! We're going up the beach away. Are you coming?
Go on ahead. We'll wait for you here. I feel kind of tired. Don't you?
Oh, yeah. I guess so, Miss Lucy.
Well, why don't we sit down a while? It's nice here.
Lucy and I sat out in a dark place where there were some roots of old trees the water had washed up.
Feel that wood. How smooth it is. Like silk.
And there was a watery smell, and the night was like as if you could put your hand out and feel it. So warm and soft and dark and sweet. Like an orange. After that, the time till we had to go back in the launch and they had to catch their train was nothing at all. Went like winking your eyes.
Go. We've got to go to the train now. Will you kiss me goodbye?
She was most crying then, but she never knew nothing I knew. She could be all busted up as I was. Gee whiz. Sometimes I wish I'd never been born. Guess you know what I mean. We went in the launch across the bay to the train like that, and it was dark, too.
What are you thinking about? You know what I was thinking?
What?
Well, I was thinking that you and I could get out of this boat right this minute and walk on the water.
Sounded foolish, all right, but I knew what she meant. And quick, we were right at the depot, and there was a big gang of yaps crowded and milling around like cattle, and how could I tell her?
Oh, it won't be long, because you're right, and I'll answer you.
I got a chance like a hay buying a fire, a swell chance. I got to answer her. Maybe she'd write me down at Marietta that way, and the letter'd come back and stamped on the front of it by the USA... There ain't any such guy or something like that. Whatever they stamp on a letter that way.
Well, goodbye, Walter.
Goodbye.
And thanks for the tip-off.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Miss Mather. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
That train went. I busted out and cried like a kid. Gee, I could have run after that train, made Man of War look like a freight train after a wreck, but socks almighty, what was the use? Did you ever see such a fool? Me trying to pass myself off for a big bug and a swell to her? Did you ever see such a fool? I'll bet you what, if I had an arm broke right now or a train had run over my foot, I wouldn't go to no doctor at all. I'd go sit down and let it hurt and hurt. That's what I do, big fool that I am. Why was I such a boob to go and tell such a lie that couldn't ever be made straight to a lady like her? If I'm not a fool, you just go and find me one. I'll quit working and be a bum and give them my job. I don't care for working and earning and saving for no such boob as myself.
You've just heard part one of our Mercury broadcast for tonight, I'm a Fool. We offer you another famous American short story for part two, maybe the most famous of all. Like our first selection, this is a study of a terrible mistake. But there all similarity ends. Clearly, Sherwood Anderson's hero lived down his mistake and lived happily ever after. The same, however, cannot be said of the murderer in Edgar Allan Poe's monologue, The Telltale Heart. That's next on the bill, but first here's Jimmy Wallington with some sound conclusion on the subject of picnics.
Out here in California, it's always picnic time. Unless, of course, we happen to have an extra heavy dew. So, as a Californian and an old hand at picnics, I want to tell you there's nothing which puts over one of these outdoor banquets better than plenty of blended splendid Pabst Blue Ribbon. Yes, that potato salad, those hard-boiled eggs. I like the devil kind myself. Those cold cuts. Everything just naturally tastes better when blended with those never less than 33 fine brews. And you know why? Well, it's because Pabst Blue Ribbon has just the right flavor for a picnic. Not too heavy, not too light, but fresh, clear, sparkling with a real bet there's no finer beer. Picnic time or any time in them. So if your dealer is unable to supply all the Pabst Blue Ribbon you'd like, why just keep on asking for blended, splendid Pabst Blue Ribbon. And now Orson Welles brings you his Mercury production of The Telltale Heart.
True! Nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It's impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. Object, there was none. Passion, there was none. I loved the old man. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. One of his eyes resembled that of a vulture. A pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. I was never kinder to him than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, so that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my head. You would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me a whole hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously. Where the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon that vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights. Every night, just at midnight, but I found the eye was always closed. And so it was impossible for me to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. Morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he'd passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine.
To think that there I was opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. He fairly chuckled at the idea. And perhaps he heard me. For he moved on his bed suddenly as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back. But no. I did not draw back. I kept pushing the door. Steadily. Steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening and the old man sprang up in the bed. I kept quite still and I said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed listening, just as I have done night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan. And I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been saying to himself, it's nothing but the wind in the chimney. It's only a mouse crossing the floor. It's merely a cricket which has made a single chirp. But it was all in vain. Because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. He cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a single dim ray, like the thread of a spider, shot from out of the crevice and full upon the vulture eye. It was open. The eye was open, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed on it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct precisely upon the damned spot. Now there came to my ears a low, dull, sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say louder, every moment. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. And then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. Stone, stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. The night waned. I worked hastily.
I took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited his corpse between the scantling. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. When I'd made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock was still dark. Dark as midnight.
Huh?
A knocking. A knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart. What had I now to fear? There entered now three men who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man I mentioned was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chanted familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale, and I wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied that ringing in my ears again, but still they sat and still they chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued until at length I found that the noise was not within my own ears. It was a low, dull, quick sound. Much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I talked more quickly, more vehemently. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key with violent gesticulations. But the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore, I swung the chair from which I'd been sitting and paraded it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder. Louder. Still the men chanted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no! They heard, they suspected, they knew. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. Louder. Hark. Louder. I shrieked. Dissemble no more, I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart.
I've just heard Orson Welles in his Mercury production of The Telltale Heart. Mr. Welles will return in just a moment. But first, let me again remind you to be patient with your dealer when occasionally these days he is unable to supply you with all the Pabst Blue Ribbon you'd like. He's doing his best, you can be sure of that. Yes, and here's something else you can be sure of. Every single bottle of Pabst Blue Ribbon you do get will, as always, be the happy blending of never less than 33 fine brews. Yes, every foaming, frosty glass you enjoy will, as always, have that famous Pabst Blue Ribbon flavor. Not too heavy, not too light, but fresh, clean, sparkling, with a real beer taste coming through the way you like it. So keep asking for blended, splendid Pabst Blue Ribbon. And now, Mr. Welles.
Next week, Moby Dick. Until then, the Mercury remains, as always, obediently yours.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.